From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. I'm Josie Huang in for A. Martinez. As protesters press for reforms, the LAPD announces it's going to invest more in community policing. Meanwhile, historical figures are being toppled, literally.
I think what we saw as the statues were coming down, it seems like the opening of a conversation to me.
And the Emmys, did your favorite shows get nods? It's all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. This is Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Josie Huang in for A. Martinez. So glad to have you with us. Coming up, once again, there's talk of reform in the LAPD, but could a newly proposed expansion of an old community policing program bring the change many have been calling for? We get into the debate. And during the upcoming hot, windy days, big utility companies can shut off power to communities where electrical fires could start. But what happens to the people who lose power? Well, microgrids, they may be the answer. That's ahead in the show. But first, for months, protesters have called on authorities to stop the over-policing of people of color. And so yesterday, LA Mayor Eric Garcetti announced the expansion of one LAPD program that could address this issue. The Community Safety Partnership, or CSP, has been operating on a small scale in places like South LA for almost a decade. In his announcement, Garcetti explained that officers in the CSP are tasked with building more relationships in the neighborhoods they patrol.
That police officers and community members know each other's names, so that they can sit down together and talk about their neighborhood, so that a police officer looks at her assignment not as an assignment anymore, but her opportunity to join the fabric of a neighborhood.
Garcetti said that a new permanent bureau will be created to coordinate the program and that its reach will eventually go beyond the 9 neighborhoods where it is now. So today we want to explain how this program works on the ground and whether expanding it throughout the city would truly address what protesters are asking for. With us now is Georgia Leap. She's director of the Social Justice Research Partnership at UCLA, where she specializes in gang intervention and communities. Welcome, Georgia.
Thanks for having me.
Georgia, you have made this your work studying the LAPD's community policing program, CSP. Could you give us some background about how it started and where and why there?
This program started as the brilliant idea of Connie Rice and Susan Lee, and they worked with Chief Charlie Beck. And their idea was to have a specially trained cadre of LAPD officers who would not be gladiators, but who would be guardians and would build relationships with and partnerships with residents on the ground. It started in the housing developments of Watts in South LA and also at Ramona Gardens in Boyle Heights. And really what began during the tenure of Chief Beck slowly expanded. I've got to add in here that at the exact same time, Officer Amata Tangarides was working on relationship building in Watts. So this was kind of an intertwined thread working its way through the LAPD, both by an officer and by the chief working with Connie Rice and Susan Lee.
And I want to get to Amata Tangarides, who you just mentioned, because she is going to be leading this program. But I wanted to ask you first, what are some examples of how an officer who's in the neighborhood through community policing, CSP, how that officer would operate differently than another LAPD officer who patrols those same streets but has not been trained through this program?
They operate in a radically different way. First of all, they begin with a process called truth and reconciliation, where they talk to the community about what the LAPD has done wrong and apologize for its past history. Even in certain examples, some of the officers were so young, they were born after the Watts riots, obviously, and they were born a few years before the Rodney King uprising. Nevertheless, they apologize and take responsibility for the brutality of past law enforcement officers through something called truth and reconciliation. But beyond that, their efforts are relationship-based, and they are in the community for 5 years. In the past, the LAPD, it's almost a truism, just the facts, ma'am. They were not interested in relationships. They were not interested in underlying conditions. What made these CSP officers different was they were completely the opposite. They were invested in building relationships, in being collaborative, and more than anything, focused on trust, which quite candidly has never existed between these communities, between Black communities and communities of color. Mm. And their efforts were completely different.
So the training sounds completely different. The approach you're describing is different. Who will be in this force? Is it an instance where the LAPD will recruit from their existing cadre of officers, or will individuals be able to apply to be a part of this?
The way it's always worked, and the way I imagine it continuing to work, is that individuals apply, and not everybody who applies is accepted. It's not a slam dunk. There's a whole interview and assessment process. But I think it's really important to say that the core components of CSP, the relationship building, the collaborative processes, the guardian mentality, not the gladiator, but the guardian, these are going to be the core components of the LAPD moving forward. I liken it to everybody goes to medical school and then certain individuals choose a specialty. Everyone in the LAPD will go to CSP schools. They're all going to learn the core components. And then specific officers will choose to operate in these zones, in these CSP zones.
Mm. It's clear listening to you that you are a fan of this program, but I know you also look at the data. What are some of the positive outcomes from this program?
Well, I do want to take a step back. I am positive about this program, but in the end, I'm a researcher. And I can tell you, and I often say, the evaluation we conducted was not a love letter to the CSP. Those core components led to some very positive outcomes. But at the same time, there were great challenges that came up and they're going to have to be addressed by the LAPD. You know, with relationship building, there has to be equality. The LAPD cannot be first among equals. And it was found over the years that their fidelity to the model, their faithfulness, began to sort of fall apart. And they're used to being in control. They're used to being first among equals. The community is asking for transparency, and they're also saying, we must be equals. Amada Tangaridi said something yesterday that was very important. The LAPD wants to stand aside and let the community take leadership on its programs, on its efforts, on its changes, and on its safety.
If you're just joining us now, we are speaking to Georgia Leap. She is director of the Social Justice Research Partnership at UCLA. She's been looking at community policing in LA, which the LAPD is expanding. The announcement was made yesterday. It seems, Georgia, that it is one of City Hall's answers to all the protests about policing and the need for reform. There is, of course, as you would imagine, a lot of skepticism among those calling for police reform. Do you believe that an expansion of community policing can lead to a change in the overall culture of LA's police force, and in particular, how the LAPD treats people of color?
Look, I want to believe in it, but I am not going to say this is going to make everything better. I do not see this as an automatic panacea. Any organization is going to resist change. I don't care if it's UCLA or KPCC or the LAPD. And let's be blunt. Law enforcement agencies are particularly resistant to change. And LAPD has been under a federal consent decree in the past because they've been so resistant to change. This is not something that's going to happen overnight, but this is a model, this is developed, and this does have leadership. So I am hopeful, but still agnostic, because the change in the DNA of the LAPD is going to take a while, let's just say.
Black Lives Matter protesters have repeatedly called for the defunding of police and reallocating that money into more community programs. And so in response to the mayor's announcement, the co-founder of the LA chapter of Black Lives Matter, Melina Abdullah, she told us, in her opinion, that the move is far off the mark.
No way should defund the police be misinterpreted as expand the police and just put the word community in front of it. So this community safety partnership means more spending on police. It means having police do more jobs that they have no business doing and are not qualified to do.
Georgia, is this program or the expansion of the program, does that mean that there's going to be a greater investment of time and money poured back into the LAPD?
No. In fact, and they said this at the mayor's press conference yesterday, this program has to be operated within the now reduced budget of the LAPD. So there's not going to be extra money. What this really means is that probably funding is going to be taken from other departments and, other bureaus within the LAPD and put into CSP. That means less money, less funding, less boots on the ground for other departments. This is all part of the movement into a different type of law enforcement. I also embrace the idea that there are other individuals more well-qualified, more well-suited to take care of many of the problems our communities face. I'm a social worker. I believe in this. Mm-hmm. But we've got whatever component of law enforcement remains, whether 10% of its budget is taken away or 90% of its budget is taken away, there will be a law enforcement component to public safety. Mm-hmm. And we've got to ask ourselves, even if it's 10%, and I'm not saying it's going to be that, but even if it's 10%, is it going to be a gladiator or is it going to be a guardian? Mm-hmm. We've got to think of what that law enforcement component is going to look like, act like, be like on our streets.
Georgia, we have just about a minute left, but, you know, in terms of what this program looks like, it's been viewed by some as an odd duck among police in the neighborhood. We spoke with journalist Sara Suleiman, who observed the program when it first got off the ground, and she shared one story with us about a standoff between two groups of kids using Ted Watkins Park in South L.A. and how LAPD officers and L.A. sheriff deputies handled it.
The tension built over a couple of days, and the sheriffs control Ted Watkins Park and LAPD controls the streets around it. And they watched it happen and did nothing about it. And then finally, the sheriffs ended up shooing the kids into the streets in the hopes that it would just become LAPD's problem as opposed to calling a CSP to de-escalate that kind of tension.
Suleiman says several people were shot and hurt in the aftermath, and the CSP officers were angry they were not looped in by their colleagues. What are the problems that you foresee with coordinating this program as it expands with the work of other officers in the same area?
This is the exact thing I was talking about when I talked about the resistance of law enforcement to change. What's going to change this and what's going to loop people in is the need for strong law enforcement leadership, like Chief Moore, who has said this is the future of the LAPD. And Chief Moore is going to have to call up the sheriff, whoever that sheriff may be, and say, listen, we have got to coordinate. We can't have one badge trying to outdo the other. And that
should I ask another question?
Sure, absolutely.
Oh, and these values of the CSP program sound like something that all LAPD officers should be doing anyways. Is there a problem that it's set up to be a separate culture? And how do you track that within the force?
Look, there's two ways. The first is through training, and the second is through evaluation. Officers are evaluated on their performance, and we're going to have to change the way that their performance is evaluated, not on arrests, but how effective they are with de-escalation and how effective they are in building relationships in the community. We've got to change the whole structure. It's a big job, but it's necessary because this is what our communities need.
Georgia Leap, she is director of the Social Justice Research Partnership at UCLA, where she specializes in gang intervention in communities. Thank you so much, Georgia, for your insights.
Thanks so much, Isabel.
Coming up, we have a really interesting roundtable talk with a group of local cultural historians. We wanted to ask them what they thought about all the monuments and memorials that have been toppled and defaced in recent weeks during protests against racial oppression and police brutality. They're historians, so they're in the business of preserving history, but they also are going to talk to us about how history is written by those in power and how history can be rewritten with context and more voices. Stay with us for that conversation next on Take Two.
you don't own me. I'm not just one of your many toys. You don't own me. Don't say I can't go with other boys.
Now with Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC, I'm Josie Huang in for A. Martinez. All throughout the country, we've seen statues and other monuments come down in recent weeks as part of protests against racism and police brutality. We're talking about Confederate statues, those of Christopher Columbus, Junipero Serra, and even a few of the country's founders. They've been removed, or they will be soon. These monuments that dot our parks and city centers are becoming more widely viewed as problematic symbols. Now, this is not entirely new. So what is it about this moment, and where do we go from here? For that, we've assembled a roundtable of historians. First up, Tyree Boyd Pates. He's Associate Curator of Western History at the Autry Museum of the American West. Welcome back.
Thank you so much.
Next, we have Natalia Molina. She's Professor of American Studies and Ethnicity at USC. Hello.
I'm glad to be in conversation with you.
And last but not least, Amanda Wixon, Assistant Curator at the Autry as well. Welcome.
Hello.
So what are your personal takes on the removal of statues, whether by protesters or, you know, taken down through some more official process by city officials or the Catholic Church in the instance of some of the Serra statues? Amanda, let's start with you.
Specifically about Serra, that's a long history that that comes with it. So, and in fact, it predates his arrival even. So a lot of people are upset, and it's a time for Native Americans. They're starting to address their healing more and more. And so to be oppressed by all these stories and myths about Junipero Serra, I think it's harder for them to be oppressed by these stories than it is for people just to take down statues. It's also, I think, stressed in the community that this is just, it's been a long time coming. And also, it's just a step. It's just a step into what else? It's not like you tear the statues down and then everything's fine. It's just an expression of a movement that's been building for decades.
And Amanda, I want to get into what those next steps should be. But before we move on to that, Tyree, you, like Amanda, work at the Autry, a museum, which is all about exhibiting artifacts and other objects from the past to help us understand us today. What goes through your mind when you see monuments toppled?
The community response and understanding their vantage point and their addressal of history overarchingly. I think in this moment, we as historians are actively involved in rapidly responding, whether it be through collecting or discussing larger historical points. But in this moment, I think it's valuable to listen to the communities and the descendants of these figures in real time in order to understand where we should all go based off their proximity to that individual figure and the myths surrounding.
Natalia, what does the removal of these statues and monuments represent to you?
For me, I want to pick up on Amanda's point about that this is a step. And so the removal to me is a step in a conversation. I think what we saw as the statues were coming down, and you can even watch the Serra one being pulled down in Alvera Street, there's this very kind of visceral moment, this cathartic moment that you really feel it.
One, two.
And it seems like the opening of a conversation to me. It's a lot of that pent-up anger, that resentment, that sadness, that hurt was around so many of these conversations had been silenced. And taking down the statues is not the end point for that, but the beginning to be thinking about, well, what would constitute a good memorial? What do we want done to address these hurts in the past? How do we move forward? And so I hope that people see this as a beginning, not an end point.
And why is this beginning happening at this moment? As we were mentioning that a lot of these concerns about these figures, controversial figures, have been around for decades, if not centuries. What is it about the time that we're in right now? I'll direct that to you, Natalia.
What we're seeing is lots of calls for structural change, lots of calls to deal with structures such as prisons with mass incarceration, with policing, with defunding the police. There are calls for racial justice. In my work, I talk about the notion that race is a relational concept, that people see the links between these racialized groups, race and ethnicities. And so linking racial justice and indigenous sovereignty is not a surprise. Along with that structural change is that we're seeing that people want a call in the change to cultural narratives. It's not enough to just change laws and policies because people don't always understand the why. They think that the policing or they think that certain laws or whatever those whatever they're protesting that it's uncalled for. Why do we need to change that? Because cultural narratives have supported that we need those structures in place. And the toppling of the statues is one way to change that cultural narrative.
Tyree, how history has been taught to us has not always been complete. What do you think needs to change here? And how do we move forward with changing how we learn about history?
Thank you for that question. I think what this moment does is opens up the wounds and also begins the larger healing that many of these communities have sought to have recognized for far too long. For far too long, these communities have seen their experiences marginalized and seen on the fringes within class settings and other social settings. But this is a redemptive conversation that actually begins to center their lived experiences and their ancestors in real time. And that's the true value. I know as a historian and I'm among curators at the Autry, who are constantly reimagining and reigniting discussions about how race, class, and history intersect within the West. And right now, I find no surprise that major occurrences and monuments are toppling even on Alvera Street as they are in our nation's capital. And this is a conversation I think the historians have had for a long time, and I'm glad to be involved with this one today.
Natalia, do you think in this conversation that there is value in having memorials and monuments still? I mean, as long as humans have been around, they've seemed to have always left totems of their existence and their past. Is it something in our DNA that makes us want to commemorate the past? And do you think we should be still having memorials?
We can definitely still have memorials, but those memorials should open a conversation and they should acknowledge that there's a 360-degree view that you can do of that memorial. So it's not just a sort of celebratory history. That even the memorials that are in place right now, some of them, you know, might have been able to stay if we had had conversations about them. So, for example, you know, having that Teddy Roosevelt statue at the Met in New York. What if they're, you know, that is a powerful organization. What if they had done exhibits all along around that and how that statue even came to be, what Manifest Destiny was, art programming around it? You know, we have a National Endowment for the Humanities. We have a National Endowment for the Arts. One heartbreaking moment of being a professor is when you teach a class and, you know, you have some of the best and brightest students in there and they come up to you after class and they say, I never knew about those workers. I never knew about those immigrants. You're actually talking about my dad now. I always wondered why my grandfather was a citizen of the U.S., but my dad was born in Mexico. Some of these histories, even when they're our own family histories, are so painful that people don't know how to talk about them. And so it's another way that we can open up that conversation is putting these statues or putting future memorials in dialogue. You know, in a city is incredibly diverse is Los Angeles, with people coming from over 140 countries speaking, you know, over 200 languages. There's not going to be one memorial that's going to capture that experience.
I want to ask Amanda about this. How do you feel about instead of a Sarah statue coming down, keeping it up and adding some kind of context, as Natalia was mentioning, first person accounts, a plaque, adding some more background? Is there value in that?
Absolutely. I mean, prior to this, it's kind of this violent expression, if you can say, of sovereignty. There's been, you know, conversations around statues of like Thomas Jefferson, say, in different university campuses. And a lot of universities decided to put plaques next to it or have some kind of QR code, some interactive code where you could learn more about that history. So it's not new by any means. But it's definitely, I like what Natalia said about monuments as this tool for opening discussion. That's exactly what it should be. Because when I teach, I'm always stunned by students that say, well, you know, I never learned this because that's just not what they do in high school. It's been a long time kind of state building history and federal programming that have obscured everything.
Tyree, as Amanda mentioned, it's not new to add this context. Do you have any recommendations for, you know, different, you know, church, the Catholic Church, or for the different cities where these different controversial statues are located, how they might go about updating their memorial to add this context we've been talking about?
It's vital that we don't erase these monuments because they serve as a litmus test of where the general public saw itself and who it deified. And currently, as we have these ontological conversations about the ways in which white supremacy has been embedded in infrastructures in this country, I think that these figures also provide a litmus test as to how we saw ourselves, or at least we sought to place ourselves and build ourselves off those ideals. But this reimagining that is happening at the grassroots level, and it's making its way up the proverbial ranks, should not be lost and should be made in a contextual way, whether it be through plaque and or within a museum or warehouse setting.
And it certainly, the issue is certainly moving up the ranks in LA. It's moved all the way up to the mayor's office. And Natalia, you're part of a new commission put together by the mayor's office on civic memory. Talk about civic memory and what the commission's job is.
Yes. So we have a committee on civic memory headed by Chris Hawthorne and by USC professor Bill Deverell from the Huntington USC Institute on California in the West. And our goal is to produce a concrete set of recommendations very much along the lines of the conversation we're having today. We would want people to understand that when we're looking at Los Angeles, that this is really a layered history in terms of overlooked figures that we need to discuss, other kinds of memorials that we might produce. And so we've put together a group of roughly about 30 individuals from a variety of fields and a variety of expertises, from, you know, architects, artists, writers, historians, in order to have a conversation and ask probing questions so that we could figure out what are recommendations that we can make to the city so that we can start designing memorials. And you know, these might be memorials that are statues, they might be places, they might be gardens, they might be civic markers, such as, you know, London has these blue plaques all over the city. Germany has these Stolpersteins, these stumbling stones that actually evoke very painful histories of Nazi Germany. And this was actually initiated by a German artist, not by a civic project. So there's lots of ways that we can do this and lots of ways that we can make this flexible and make it a real learning experience and a conversation starter for groups.
Because all three of you are historians, I do imagine that you walk around LA and you see statues and monuments with a deeper knowledge. You have that historical context. And I'm curious, I'll start with you first, Tyree. Is it obvious to you who has been left out of the LA history that's been written and who has been included?
Completely. I think you can see it in the figures that have great prominence throughout the city of Los Angeles. And this is exactly the issue. I would be remiss to not center that the responses of the communities that are toppling these monuments down have been speaking for decades upon decades, if not centuries, about the traumas that they've incurred because of these individuals. I would be, again, remiss to not amplify them and say that they've typically been ignored by their the authorities as to how these individuals have exacted violence upon them and have often allowed that violence to continue. And so when thinking about all of the figures and the names who have not been given the platform, I think that's, in fact, the job of historians like myself. It's to amplify Biddy Mason and her role in fostering and cultivating Los Angeles for Black Angelenos. And it's the Owens families and the countless others who have been erased. And I think as we reimagine this moment, hopefully we can again center those families and those trailblazers in ways in which will be gainful in democratizing the portrayal of Los Angeles as a whole.
I'm sure Natalia's taking notes. Amanda, I wanted to pose the question to you as well. When you walk around LA or in different cities in Southern California, what do you see in terms of who we are paying homage to? You know, we've been talking a lot this conversation about Junipero Serra, but I imagine there are other statues in Southern California that are probably, you know, should give us pause.
Well, certainly, in my opinion, there's a lack of statues for the people that we should be honoring, and it goes back to honoring. There's a big push right now to make these land acknowledgments about the indigenous people that lived wherever you are in the United States. And that's an important step, but we really don't go far enough in that. I mean, it's getting to the point where it's just lip service for land acknowledgments. I think we need more support for these kind of deep dives into history to make connections with the public. Definitely so many communities have been marginalized, and I'd like to see more kind of at a state level, a state directive.
Thank you for joining us all. That would be Tyree Boyd Pates, Associate Curator of Western History at the Autry, Natalia Molina, Professor of American Studies and Ethnicity at USC, and Amanda Wixon, Assistant Curator at the Autry as well. Thank you all so much for taking this time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up momentarily, join us as we hear from the women who are transitioning out of the military and into civilian life. The experience is different from their male counterparts, and so is the healthcare they're getting. Also, the fire season is coming up. Great. That's going to lead people to having their power shut off as a precaution by the utility companies. And some folks are being resourceful about the situation, pun intended. Stay with us for more.
Down the street, and I start to cry each time we meet. Walk on by, walk on by. Make believe that you don't see the tears, just let me grieve in private. 'Cause each time I see you, I break down and cry.
You're listening to Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Josie Huang, in for A. Martinez. Last year, 20,000 women transitioned out of the military. Yet compared to men, they're much less likely to get their medical care through the Department of Veteran Affairs. So the agency has stepped up its efforts to convince female veterans to give VA healthcare a chance. Jennifer Brooklyn reports for the American Homefront Project.
To understand who the VA was set up to serve, look no further than the agency's motto, to care for him who shall have borne the battle and for his widow and his orphan. When that motto was adopted by the VA in 1959, women were capped at 2% of the enlisted force. Women veterans have historically, even officially, been an afterthought. So women like Tanisha Tumblin, a Marine stationed at Camp Lejeune, have repaid the favor.
When I think of the VA, I see wounded warriors and I see broken people and someone without a limb. Women's clinic never crossed my mind.
Tumblin is separating from the military this summer after 6 years in the Corps. And like many other service women, she assumed VA healthcare would feel the same as the medical attention she received on active duty. That is to say, not exactly attuned to a woman's needs.
When it comes to medical treatment for women, they automatically assume, oh, she's just saying she's hurting so that she can get out of this field op or this hike. And that's not the case at all. And another thing, they assume that we're all pregnant.
When she began her separation process, Tumlin never considered enrolling to get her health care through the VA. That's part of a long-standing trend, one the VA is hoping to reverse with the Women's Health Transition Training Program. Nancy Marr is the program's senior manager. She says female veterans wait longer than men do to enroll in VA healthcare, and at just 25% are under-enrolled in general.
They think that the VA is only for men. They don't think that VA is a quality place to get care, and they're just very unaware of all the healthcare services that the VA has for women.
Marr sees that under-enrollment as a big problem for women, whose health needs could fall through the cracks as they transition out of the military. The VA says women face greater health-related challenges after military service compared to their male counterparts, including chronic pain, depression, and suicide. So to persuade women to enroll in VA healthcare, the program holds interactive seminars for troops who are about to leave the service.
Welcome again to the Women's Health Transition Training. We're so happy you've taken time out of your busy day to join us.
Kelly Griffiths is a trainer with the program, addressing online participants from Lackland Air Force Base.
We're in the military for a long time. We have our needs taken care of. But just know, as you transition out, the VA can be there for you, as you can see, for a whole host of reasons.
Griffiths says the seminars are totally different from most military training. They're led by female veterans like her who use VA healthcare themselves. And Griffiths says just having a training geared toward women makes a difference.
They're so happy when they leave because there wasn't anything in the military that was ever women specific.
Marr says it's working. Women who've taken the training are more likely to enroll in VA healthcare and to do so more quickly. At Fort Hood, Texas, Larry Rocha is retiring from the Army. She says the training made her see the VA differently.
We sit back and we listen to, you know, the horror stories about receiving medical care at the VA, and knowing that we have the option as women to seek all of our health care from the VA when it comes to women's health was a huge relief to me.
Rocha says she plans on enrolling, and Tumblin says the training gave her a change of heart, too.
I definitely need to recognize that the VA is not at all like Marine Corps medical, and that they really are out there to help. And there are programs geared towards women. So no, I don't have that mindset about the VA anymore.
As her time in the Marine Corps comes to an end, she'll be signing up for healthcare at her local VA. I'm Jennifer Brooklyn reporting.
Moving on, you might remember during fire season last year, some communities like Agua Dulce put up with Edison power outages for days to reduce fire risk, and that made people angry.
This is unacceptable as far as I can see. I think you people are thoughtless, and I think we're tired of it.
Yes.
The company says it must continue its policy of turning off power this coming fire season to keep its equipment from starting fires. But in the meantime, people are searching for alternatives to keep the power flowing. KPCC's Sharon McNary has more.
I'm in the gym at San Jacinto High School in Riverside County. During emergencies like a fire or earthquake, it doubles as a Red Cross shelter for the community. It's pretty big. There's room for 200 cots on the gym floor or 2,700 people in the bleachers. Right now it's empty, so of course I have to check for an echo.
Hello!
The school has solar panels and Tesla batteries that supply about 85% of what the campus needs. But that system alone isn't enough for the gym to keep the lights and air conditioning on during a power outage. Corey Lawson manages the campus buildings here. He says they needed one more thing to make the gym energy self-sufficient, and Edison was looking for the right place to try something new.
So Edison approached us because of our unique position here in San Jacinto. We're surrounded by farmlands and mountain areas, which are some high fire risk areas.
Edison added circuits and software, allowing the school gym to operate independently of the rest of the school's power system and the surrounding power lines. The gym will be able to function as a microgrid, a self-sufficient power island.
This is going to add that capability to have power, to be able to charge your phones, to have HVAC, have food, a lot of other benefits on top of what a standard emergency Red Cross shelter is.
When I was there, a crew of Edison electricians were inside a chain link enclosure, completing the work of channeling the power from the Tesla batteries to the gym circuits. All that work cost Edison around $200,000. It should be operational this fall. This one is solar, but there are other kinds of microgrids. The tiny tourist town of Julian, famous for its apples and apple pies, has a microgrid that runs off a big gas generator when fire danger is high and the surrounding power grid is offline. And some microgrids use hydrogen fuel cells that create energy from natural gas and fresh air. It's the same technology used in fuel cell cars.
1, 2, 3, hey!
Recently, Southern California Gas Company celebrated their new microgrid at an equipment storage plant in Pico Rivera. If the power goes out, this plant can isolate itself from the power grid and run on the energy the fuel cells put out. The fuel cells look like big brushed steel boxes, like a row of really big refrigerators. Bloom Energy built the fuel cells. Bloom's Chris Kim says the fuel cells combine natural gas with oxygen from the ambient air.
You effectively get an electrochemical process inside the box that makes electricity without any combustion.
By creating this energy island, SoCalGas would avoid interruptions in the functioning of this equipment storage plant if there were a power outage. It means they'd be able to go out and repair damage to their gas lines if an earthquake hit. These are small-scale systems, but community-scale microgrids that are larger and power an entire neighborhood, those are years away. Edison had planned to do several more projects like the one at San Jacinto High School gym, but they turned out to be too expensive. This coming fire season, in those places that had extended outages like Acton, Agua Dulce, and Idlewild, Edison is creating what it calls resiliency zones. They'll keep local pharmacies running on diesel generators and hand out snacks and water and let you charge your phone and computer. For now, it's still up to individual businesses and households to be energy self-sufficient. And Edison is encouraging that by offering discounts on generators and batteries. For some qualifying customers, those items could be close to free. So if you want a microgrid, best build one yourself. Covering infrastructure, I'm Sharon McNary.
The Emmy nominations were just announced today. We're going to talk to our resident industry insider, John Horn, and get his takes on who got nommed, who got snubbed. Reese Witherspoon was in 3 prestige shows, got no love, but Zendaya of HBO's Euphoria got her first nod. We'll hear some of the very entertaining nomination announcements today by SNL alum Leslie Jones. She gets an award herself. Stay with us.
Tonight, I'm gonna have myself a real good time. I feel alive.
Back now with Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on kpcc.org. I'm Josie Huang in for A. Martinez. This morning, comedic actress Leslie Jones led the online announcement of the 72nd annual Primetime Emmy nominations in a very bare-bones studio.
They brought me here on an empty plane. I had to get my own drink and everything. Now, later I found out it was a private plane, but they could have let me know that. Then they brought me to an empty dressing room where I got dressed, and then they brought me to this room where there's nobody in here but a cameraman.
Really makes you wonder, what are the Emmys going to look like? Or the red carpet, for that matter. I'm sure they'll figure something out. Well, here to break down the nominations with us is John Horn. He's host of the Elias Studios podcast, Hollywood the Sequel. Hey, John.
Hey there.
So, John, before we get into the nominations themselves, let's put it all in context. In normal times, these would have been announced earlier this summer and would have come after a lot of Emmy campaigning. How do you think the restrictions on social gatherings and hobnobbing, how that affected the actual voting this year?
Well, I would hope that it actually meant that the shows that were worthy got attention as opposed to the shows that had the biggest parties and events. So over the last couple of years, the spending on Emmy campaigning has gone through the roof. Netflix especially has spent millions of dollars. They have parties, they have screenings, they have kind of studios that are taken over with props and costumes from various shows. And it's very different. You can't do that now, and you can't really do much beyond a Zoom call or maybe hoping that people are going to check out your show. That said, Netflix is gaining a lot of subscribers, I think 26 million so far this year. And based on the outcome of the Emmy voting, I have to think a lot of the people who are signing up for Netflix or at least watching it are Emmy voters.
Well, there's nothing, what I'm going to mention next has nothing to do with the pandemic, but the TV Academy had some other rule changes. What were those?
Well, it's a little bit like what the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences has been doing with the Oscars. Typically, the Best Picture nomination would be between 5 and 10 movies based on this kind of complicated way that voting happens, and the Oscars now say, going forward, it's going to be 10 movies every year. So the TV Academy, in trying to do the same thing, kind of draw more films into competition, more TV shows into competition, they've boosted the number of nominations up to 8 in certain categories. And it still doesn't capture a lot. According to John Landgraf, who has talked a lot about Peak TV, the head of FX, by his tally, there were 532 scripted series last year. And a lot of them, not all of them, a lot of them applied for Emmys, and it meant there were a lot of people in a lot of categories and a lot of shows where you typically have 5, there are now 8 nominees.
Right. I saw some confusion online where people were like, oh, look at how come some categories have more than others. But John, given these changes, what do this year's Emmy nominations tell us about where the TV business is now in terms of inclusion?
Well, I think there is progress that's being made. Now, if you look at the Academy Awards, which I think is a fair baseline comparison, last year there was only one non-white actor nominated, Cynthia Erivo from Harriet, in a major acting category. The TV Academy does a little bit better. There are more than 100 people up for various acting awards. And if you start going down, you know, some of these are small parts, guest parts, but there were 36 actors of color nominated this year, and that's up from 24 last year. Now, there are a lot of things where you look more closely, it's not that impressive. Sandra Oh was one of the only Asian actors nominated. Rami Youssef is the only actor creator of Middle Eastern descent. Notable absence of Latinos. Giancarlo Esposito is Italian and African-American. He got a nomination, or he got 2 nominations, actually. But generally, a lot of familiar names in a lot of the big categories. It gets a little bit more diverse once you start looking into the series that are up for major awards.
Well, a lot of those series that are being nominated are at Netflix, which has the most nominations, 160. HBO had 107, followed by NBC, which was a distant third with 47. We should notice many of these are Creative Arts Emmy nominations. So maybe not everybody who watches Netflix would be familiar with some of the folks getting these noms. But why do these stats matter? And do they matter to average viewers, or who's keeping track?
Well, they matter to the creative community. So if you are somebody who wants to make a TV series and Netflix says we have the most nominations, a record 160 this year, and there are over 52 different shows. So there are obviously some shows that led the way, but 52 different Netflix shows got nominations. Netflix has more nominations than NBC, CBS, ABC, and Fox combined. And if you're a creative person and you want some hardware on your mantle, you would say, well, maybe they've got a better chance. And if you're a Netflix subscriber, maybe it elevates certain shows up. You said, wow, that thing got an Emmy nomination. I might want to check it out. And it's also important for new streaming services like Disney Plus, where The Mandalorian got nominations in some major categories. So it really elevates the profile of the show, and it elevates the profile of the company that is making and distributing it.
Well, John, let's get into the top categories that viewers are going to be the most familiar with. Let's start with limited series. The show that got the most Emmy nominations today was Watchmen on HBO. It got 26 nominations. Why do you think it led the pack?
Well, it's an incredibly good show. I mean, I would say, first of all, it's really well made. Second of all, it's incredibly topical. This is a show that started its first episode. First images were of the Tulsa race riots of 1921. This is a series about race, about policing, about corruption. It could not be more topical. And it's really good. And it's a total, it's even though it's loosely based on the graphic novel, it's a total reimagining of that world. Fantastic actors from top to bottom. It just felt like something that, even though it was fantastical and had some science fiction in it, it felt very much of the moment and very much addressing issues that a lot of people are wrestling with right now.
We're running out of time, so I'm going to run to the Outstanding Comedy Series category. Last year, Fleabag won, but that show ended. Here's Leslie Jones again. She's announcing the nominees this morning.
Curb Your Enthusiasm, Dead to Me. I love that show. The Good Place! Ah! Insecure! Insecure! The Kominsky Method. Did I say that right? The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, Schitt's Creek, What We Do in the Shadows. Oh, these are the nominees for Outstanding Comedy Series. You guys, congratulations!
John, honestly, I didn't need coffee after that. What struck you about the comedy picks this year?
Well, first of all, so we don't get in trouble with the government, Schitt's Creek is S-C-H-I-T-T apostrophe S, Schitt's Creek. I think Issa Rae's Insecure. I think that was really important that that show got in. I was really hoping Rami Youssef's show got in. He did get a nomination, but it does represent a pretty broad spectrum of shows, especially Issa Rae with Insecure. So
love
I think that,
that
is a really important nomination.
Love her. Love the show. Very quickly, do we know how the Emmy telecast is going to happen?
No. They say it's going to happen. They say that they have a host, Jimmy Kimmel. They say they're going to hand out hardware. I don't know if they're going to hand it out physically, if they're going to give people a receipt and they're going to go pick it up at their local Amazon Dropbox. I really don't know. The idea of people gathering in a mass crowd, walking a red carpet in the middle of September seems impossible. But, you know, live TV is doing really well right now in the ratings. So I think they'll try to figure out a way, but I can't see it looking anything like what it has in the past. Jimmy Kimmel said, I don't know where we will do this or how we will do this or even why we are doing this, but we are doing it and I'm hosting it. I think that's about all we know right now.
Okay. John Horn, host of the Elias Studios podcast, Hollywood the Sequel. Please find it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. Thank you so much, John.
Thanks, Josie.
All right, everybody, thank you so much for joining us on this Tuesday. I'm Josie Huang. I've been filling in for A. Martinez. I'll be back one more day tomorrow, and I can't wait to be with you guys then. Talk to you then. Bye-bye. Ooh, child, things will get brighter. Someday, yeah, we'll put it together and we'll get it undone.